The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Hello, everybody. Hey. Okay. We are thrilled to welcome back our 2007 One Book, One Philadelphia author, Carlos Eyre, as we celebrate the publication of his second memoir, Learning to Die in Miami, Confessions of a Refugee Boy. It seems like yesterday that Carlos was a major presence in Philadelphia when he and his first memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana, Confessions of a Cuban Boy, captured our hearts and indelibly impacted our region. With his lyrical evocation of his boyhood in Havana and depictions of the brutality and repressiveness of the revolution that tore him away from his family and cultural roots, and his recollections about his life as an exile in America, Carlos not only shared his unique immigrant story, but caused us to reflect upon our own journeys to America. As our 2007 One Book selection, Waiting for Snow in Havana, reached tens of thousands of readers and inspired countless discussions and programs, including church sermons, dance programs, films, and theatrical performances, where we compared ideas about Carlos's book, learned more about Philadelphia's multicultural population, considered the complex issues surrounding immigration, and nothing has changed, they're more complex, and shared our own immigrant stories. Carlos was unstinting in his participation, visiting branch libraries, broadcasting interviews, attending breakfasts, luncheons, and dinners, and all the while speaking from the heart to each and every one of us. He won our affection along with our admiration, and our hope at the end of the program was that he would soon return to all of his friends in Philadelphia. That hope is being fulfilled tonight. Born in Havana in 1950, Carlos Eyre left his homeland in 1962, one of 14,000 unaccompanied children, airlifted out of Fidel Castro's Cuba by Operation Pedro Pan. He was 11 years old and carried with him only a small bag of the barest essentials, together with the vivid memories which are at the heart of his first memoir. After living in a series of foster homes in Florida and Illinois, he was reunited with his mother in Chicago in 1965. His father never left Cuba. During his high school years, Carlos worked nights as a dishwasher at a hotel in Chicago, earning the money to help support his mother, brother, and himself. After earning his PhD at Yale University in 1979, Carlos Eyre taught at St. John's University in Minnesota and at the University of Virginia. He is now the Riggs Professor of History and Religious Studies at Yale University, specializing in the social, intellectual, religious, and cultural history of late medieval and early modern Europe. Having published extensively in his field, he is currently writing a survey history of the Reformation and researching attitudes towards miracles in the 16th and 17th centuries. winner of the 2003 National Book Award, Waiting for Snow in Havana, has garnered much critical acclaim, including the most accomplished literary expression of exile sensibility to have appeared to date. With his new memoir, Carlos circles back, writing in more detail about his time in Miami and the painful days and years that followed his wrenching departure from his family and life in Havana. Critics have said about Learning to Die in Miami, it is a book that combines laughter with an abiding sense of sorrow. It is one of the more impressive memoirs on the thorny issue of immigration, and this rich, engrossing memoir has the magic realism of Gabriel Garcia Marquez, A Magical Memory Tour. And now, I am deeply honored and delighted to welcome back and introduce Philadelphia's 2007 One Book, One Philadelphia author, tonight's speaker, Professor Carlos Ayer.
Well, thank you all for being here. It's a great pleasure. It's an honor to be here with you. It's always wonderful to be in Philadelphia. I love this town. And it's starting to feel more like home, especially keep being invited back. What I'd like to do is divide my talk into basically two sections. One is the history behind my own personal story and that of the other 14,000 children who came here without their parents. And the other is to talk about the book itself, how it came to be and what's in it. But to get us going, I think it always helps, since this is a brand new book and probably most of you have not had a chance to look at it, is to just read a very, very, very brief section from this book, give you a taste of what's in it. I know that Waiting for Snow in Havana was chosen sort of because it had an immigration theme, but this book is really almost entirely, if not entirely, about the immigrant experience, much more so than Waiting for Snow. So what I'm going to read to you is a chapter about an experience I had in the classroom when I was moved to the all-English-speaking classroom and was only one of few kids in this room who was from somewhere else. This is in Miami. So here we go. Everyone knows I'm Cuban here in the sixth grade at Everglades Elementary School. Damn, how do they know? It's my tongue, of course. But I refuse to accept the fact that I haven't surpassed Desi Arnaz yet. I thought my English pronunciation was perfect. I'm in a total state of denial. Then one day, during that first week of school, I raise my hand to answer one of the teacher's questions. And he calls on me. "That's easy," I say. The entire classroom erupts into laughter. Belly laughs, not mere snickering, prolonged, outright laughter. Before I can ask myself what's wrong, the whole class starts repeating what I've just said again and again, and it sounds so wrong. "Easy, easy, easy, easy." How funny. Ha, ha, ha. Not easy, which is what I thought I had said. The laughing seems to last forever. From that day forward, I'm called Easy Boy. One girl loves to say easy again and again every time she sees me. I resolve at that moment, as they're all laughing so hard, to dedicate myself 100% to losing whatever accent is left in me. They'll never laugh at me again, I vow. Parentheses. And who do I pick on television as the finest American accent? The Beverly Hillbillies and Andy Griffith. And that's the accent I will cultivate And when I get to Chicago, finally, you know, the kids in school say, "Are you from the South?" And I'll say, "Yeah, but you have no idea how far south." Yeah, so, anyway, they'll never laugh at me again, ever. And what's this crap? What's wrong with these books? My geography and history books have chapters on Cuba and also on other Latin American countries. What I find in them is shocking. According to these books, every country in Latin America is just about the same as all the others. All of them are very, very poor and terribly backward. All of them are ruled by a tiny number of rich, nearly white but not really white people who exploit the darker-skinned poor folk and suck their blood. The photographs in the books speak volumes. Starving, barefoot peasants behind ox-drawn plows, half-naked children in straw skirts. All that's missing are bones in their noses. But wait, here's one with a bone through his nose, and he's holding a bow and arrow, too. Damn, I didn't know I was a savage. My geography book has only one photograph of Cuba, and it's of a grass hut and a half-naked, barefoot black kid standing at the door, looking hapless and helpless, parentheses, two new fiendishly similar English words I have just learned. My history book says that Cuba, like all Latin American countries, is too backward to handle democracy or genuine civilization, and that whatever little progress it has made is due to the help that the United States has offered since it freed the island from Spain's grip in 1898. I also learned that the real hero of the Cuban War of Independence was Teddy Roosevelt. Jesus H. textbook-shredding Christ. No wonder I get all these questions all the time. What was it like to wear shoes for the first time when you got to America? You had toilets in Cuba? Televisions? Hospitals? Cars? Pants? What's it like to ride on donkeys all the time? How'd you learn to read so quickly if you just got here? And so on. I might as well stick a bone through my nose and show up barefoot to confirm their worst suspicions about me. Maybe I should grunt a lot, too. The most annoying question of all is, why aren't you dark? My blonde hair throws everyone for a loop. My ancestors were barbarians just like yours, I say. Oh, hey, I say, want to learn another dirty Spanish phrase? Here you go. Soy un come mierda. I'll translate that one for you as politely as possible. I'm an idiot. This is what every Cuban child had to put up with. Even nowadays, I'm sure it hasn't changed that much. But coming as a child to a foreign country requires a certain amount of adjustment. Coming as an adult to a foreign country requires more of an adjustment. Children have a special advantage in that they're still flexible and their brains are flexible. And in my case, you know, I came at the age of 11, my tongue was still flexible. After the age of 11, it's harder and harder to lose an accent. My brother and I used to make fun of our uncle, who eventually took us in, because he just was not adjusting to the United States. He had left Cuba at the age of 62. He had left all his possessions. He was an architect, and he had his own firm. He had left that behind and came here with nothing. And my brother and I used to make fun of him because, A, he couldn't lose his accent, and B, he just could not adjust and always kept thinking about going back and reclaiming all the stuff that he'd lost. What idiots we were. What absolute idiots. But, you know, kids are idiots. Teenagers especially are idiots. But what in the world would drive any parent to send their child unaccompanied to another country, especially when there is no family at the other end to take in the child? And this is what happened with 14,064 children who were flown out of Cuba by this airlift. Has come to be known as the Pedro Pan airlift. A stupid name I hate. an American journalist gave it to the airlift, and it stuck. Stupid for many reasons, but chief one is that in Cuba, nobody called the story or film Peter Pan, Pedro Pan. Everyone called it Peter Pan. The 14,060-whatever kids are only the tip of the iceberg. We don't know how many other thousands came unaccompanied that were not part of the airlift, and it's in the thousands, too. The most shocking figure, which I did not learn until last year and blew my head open, is that when the airlift ended abruptly at the end of October of 1962, and it ended as a little fallout from the missile crisis of October 62. I'll get back to this in a minute. But when the door slammed shut and all the parents were trapped in Cuba, there were also 80,000 other children waiting to leave without their parents. So we're talking about nearly 100,000 kids in an island that at that time only had a population of 6 million. You do the math. It's an enormous percentage of the population, of the underage population. Something that speaks for itself. It is the largest migration of unaccompanied children in the history of the Western Hemisphere, North and South America. It is larger than the Kinder transport, which rescued Jewish children from Nazi Germany. And yet no one knows about this story. Hardly anyone does, because it wasn't covered at the time. And so far, only three history books have been written about the airlift. But, you know, why was it such a mystery? Why didn't anyone cover it? And most important question, why would parents do this? And this is what I think I need to explain to you so that if you pick up this book and read it, you can understand the context more fully. This is a narrative just like Waiting for Snow in Havana. I don't provide history lessons in this book. I simply narrate a story. Occasionally, I fill the reader in on this or that, but it doesn't have the whole picture of the airlift. Parents in Cuba panicked beginning in 1960 because their children were already being taken away from them by the government. Item number one, Cuba's constitution had been scrapped. There was no constitution. There was no law. The law was made up from day to day. Nobody knew what was going to happen next. Anything could happen. Whatever happened was legal. But their children were already being taken away from them. First, all schools were closed, and then later reopened as government schools in which indoctrination was part of the curriculum in every single subject. I'll give you an example. I remember a math problem from my neighbor who showed me his book. Math problem for a fifth grader. Before our glorious revolution, Jose Sanchez used to pay his scumbag landlord X number of pesos for rent. Thanks to our maximum glorious leader, Fidel Castro, he now only pays X amount for it. What percentage reduction in his rent has our wonderful revolution provided for Jose Sanchez? And every math problem was like that. Every single math problem. Worse, the so-called free education, which was now available to all of us, was not really free. It required slave labor every summer. Every child had to go work in the fields for no pay for most of the summer under deplorable conditions, under deplorable supervision, and the parents had no say whatsoever as to where their kids went or what happened to their kids while they were in these camps. The older kids, the boys, were being drafted into the army at age 18, and the older ones who were smart were being sent to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union. I actually know someone personally who actually was very little, but Fidel heard her singing and wanted to force her family to send her to the Soviet Union to study voice. And they almost did, but what happened next is they put her on a plane and sent her here by herself. I just got an email from her today. The fear was real. If any of you saw a documentary aired by CNBC recently called Escape from Havana, you heard this story about how the CIA cooked all this up as a propaganda ploy to make Cuba look bad. It's not true. Not true at all. If this was a propaganda ploy, then it was the biggest failure ever in the history of the CIA or the United States, because no one knew about this airlift. In Florida, we were processed like heads of lettuce and sent as quickly to other locations as possible. We were dispersed to 40 different states and to all different kinds of places, any place that would take us. Best place to go, and very few kids had such a place, was some relative who had already established himself or herself. Second best place was an American foster home. I don't know exactly how this was advertised, but American families were taking some of us in, not just in Florida, but all over the United States. Then there was a sharp drop-off. Next kind of place. Orphanage, boarding school, or a group home of some sort, or as eventually happened to my brother and I, a group home for juvenile delinquents. Any place that would take us, took us. But here's the deep background. Parents were desperate. They put us onto this airlift because we could get visa waivers. Visa waivers granted by the U.S. State Department through three very brave individuals in Havana who had carte blanche to give anyone who asked a visa waiver. Parents needed visas. It took them a longer time. So the whole point was, let's get the kids out as fast as possible, and then we will join them in the U.S. Or, what most families thought, including my own, this can't last very long. They'll come back. They will come back, and we'll all be reunited here, and everything will go back to the way it was before. But it didn't turn out that way, because at the end of the missile crisis, Fidel Castro shut the door tight, and nobody could leave Cuba. So he got a little angry at Nikita for taking his toys away, and this was one way in which he took it out on the Cuban people. So the parents of over 10,000 kids were trapped, and the separations became very long. In my case, it took our mom 3.5 years to make it back to us here in the U.S., and our father never got to leave, so we never saw him again. Repeat this 14,000 times over, or actually, I think, a closer figure. Kids who left alone is probably closer to 20,000-something, perhaps even close to 30,000. Who were separated from their parents. The separation was an unintended consequence, but one that everyone had in mind when the kids got on the airplane. We didn't know if we would see each other again. So what kind of... Well, ultimately, I've asked myself this question as an adult numerous times. What would drive a parent to do this? Of course, it's autonomy. And a word that has been cheapened terribly in our discourse, freedom. Plain old freedom. The liberty for a child to have a future in which there is autonomy and the child has a chance to decide. And the parents actually still have a voice in deciding how the child is brought up. Something that most of us in this country take for granted. I've been asked numerous times, would you do this? If you had been in your parents' place, would you do the same? I say yes, definitely. If I'd had the knowledge they had about what was going on and this was available, yes, I would do it. And I thank them every day when I wake up. I thank both my parents for having done this. It may seem strange to most of you, but it's a wonderful thing. Kind of like Sophie's Choice in a way. You know, there's a certain element of tragedy behind it. But it's what comes out at the other end. It really matters. Now, that's the history of the airlift. The book. It's not so much about the airlift, but it's about the process of coming to a new country and adjusting and becoming a different person. Hence the title, which is, I like to think, not depressing at all. Learning to Die in Miami. By the way, the AARP has taken a tremendous interest in this book. And at first I thought, oh, why the AARP? Then it finally dawned on me, oh, my God, They've got the completely wrong idea about what this book is. Every immigrant has to learn to die. Every immigrant dies. Doesn't matter what country they come from or what country they go to. Every immigrant has to become a new, different person. And actually, that was my initial insight in picking the title, but it goes deeper than that. Because it's not just immigrants who have to learn to die. All of us, even if we never leave our hometown, have to learn to die, because life itself takes you through different phases. And you leave certain selves behind. Life is a constant process of death and rebirth. The unseen word in the title is learning to die and to be reborn, because we all have to do this, all of us. A very prominent psychiatrist told me once that all of us adults are exiles from our childhood. We are all exiled from childhood permanently. And then as we get older through life and go through different phases, we die and we're reborn. It's very funny because I was addressing a very young audience and I said, you know, anyone who has gotten married has died. Right? And you laugh. None of these young people died. Laughed because they had no idea. They didn't have the experience. Yes, you die when you get married. Become a different person. You're never the same again. One would hope, if it was working out correctly, you should be a different person. Anyone who's had a child has died and been reborn along with the child. Everything changes. So the book is really at a deeper level about a common human experience of having to grow from oneself into another and having to come to terms with the fact that that other self never dies completely. And we all carry in us several personalities that overlap and sometimes conflict with each other. In this book, the focus, though, however, is, you know, of course, my narrative of what happened to me and to my brother and what happened specifically to Cuban kids who were part of this airlift. My own story, told here, can be divided into four parts. First, we went to camps in South Florida. And the camps were one camp for teenage boys, another camp for preteen boys, and all girls. So my brother and I were separated the minute we landed, went to different camps. And then they processed us. Second stage, my brother and I got lottery ticket number 2. We ended up with an American foster family, each of us, but different families who were friends with each other. And my brother and I saw each other about once a week, oddly enough, at church. And I say oddly enough because the families that took us in were Jewish. And my brother and I both thought we had it made. We thought, oh, God, great. Now we don't have to go to church anymore. But our families forced us to go to church and gave us money to put into the collection plate. And so we saw each other once a week, Sunday, at St. Brendan's Church in Miami. Missile crisis comes along. This happened to many kids who were in foster homes. These families had not taken us in on an open-ended basis. They thought we'd only be there for a few months. In our case, our mother was actually holding an exit permit for like November 6th or November 7th. She would have reunited with us had the door not been shut. Our families couldn't keep us, so next step, an uncle had arrived and been resettled in Bloomington, Illinois. But he wasn't ready to take us in, our poor 62-year-old uncle, who also had a disabled daughter to take care of. So they put us in a holding tank and forgot about us, this group home for juvenile delinquents, run by a Cuban couple, described in every review thus far as Dickensian. Now I know why I liked Dickens so much when I was in high school. And you say, oh, yeah, this happens. And then, after 9 months in this home, finally, a social worker finds us, sends us to our uncle, to Central Illinois. Through all this, I was in my American foster home. I was Charles. In the group home, I reverted to being Carlos. Then in Bloomington, Illinois, I very quickly became Charlie and then Chuck. And I still remember the guy who was selling me my gym shoes saying, you know, you can't be Carlos here. Nobody's going to call you that. You're going to end up being called Charlie or Chuck. So choose, Charlie or Chuck. Right there on the spot, I had to choose my name. So for 2 years of my life, I was Chuck. Similar story. Multiply it 14,000 times over. Not much in this book about the second traumatic moment for most of us, reuniting with a parent or our parents after being independent for so long. My brother and I had absolute freedom for 3 years because basically nobody cared, not even our uncle. He was too busy to care, tell us what to do. So we had absolute freedom, and now all of a sudden we had parents again. Every single Pedro Pan kid you talk to, the adjustment was difficult. But to move forward from that, how did this book come to be? What possessed me to do this again? Because actually in my profession, it's kind of a sin for me to write this kind of book. You know, I'm supposed to write books with footnotes. And I love my research. I love being a historian. I love the past. I love reconstructing the past. My history books, however, take about 10 years apiece. The one I'm working on now that you heard about, my survey of the Reformation, this is my 12th year working on that book. But in between, there's been Waiting for Snow in Havana, and then this one, An Interruption. What drove me to it is a sense of calling and of purpose, of being an eyewitness to something that happened and has been ignored. Or even worse, an eyewitness to things that happened that are constantly denied or twisted and told the wrong way. A colleague of mine, Miroslav Volf, a theologian who himself also grew up in a communist country in the former Yugoslavia and actually spent time in prison simply for being a Christian. He's written many wonderful books on forgiveness and also on memory. One of his books had a tremendous impact on me because in it he quotes Eli Wiesel. And Wiesel's talking, of course, about memory of the Holocaust and that memory vis-a-vis the Holocaust deniers. And Wiesel gets a little deeper and he says, you know, when an injustice has been committed, when an evil has been committed, and it is allowed to stand there in history unchallenged, unreported, that evil endures. And actually those who commit that evil get away with it. And the evil perdures from generation to generation if it is not exposed as what it was. This is my mission, really at a deeper level, writing these books. It's to call attention to a place not far from the U.S., 90 miles from Key West. It's one of the worst hellholes on earth, a totalitarian regime that has absolutely no respect for human rights, that intentionally, still to this day, intentionally divides families, regardless of what it said during the Elian Gonzalez affair about kids needing to be with their parents. They divide families constantly. For instance, to this day, the doctors who are sent to Venezuela and other countries are not allowed to go with their families. Anyone in Cuba who is allowed to travel abroad, and it's damn few, can never, ever go with their families unless they're highly, highly placed. This happens to this day. The so-called free education is still what it was in 1960. It requires slave labor every summer. And yet, I hear denials of this over and over again, constantly, faced with denials of what's going on. I can't tell you how many times I've been called a liar in public. Perhaps some of you tonight might call me a liar. It happens in almost every gathering this size. The fact is, as a historian, I've taken a giant leap and written from memory. And memory is the most potent account of the past. It is the most direct connection that we have to the past. And I think I spoke about this the last time I was here. About, you know, I said, just think how much history is in this room, inside everybody's heads, in our memories. The history that's in this room is just incredible. The most direct connection to the past is memory. The most potent eyewitness to injustice is memory. So when that memory gets recorded, there it stands. And it's very hard to argue with a narrative. For instance, I'll give you a little example of something that happened between me and my editor for the first book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, an event that's recounted here in greater detail. Our mother tried to leave to meet with us from day one. Actually, what she said is, if I have to dig a tunnel under the Straits of Florida, I will. But she just kept trying to go to other embassies to find some other way out, and she finally did find a way out. I can't remember if it was Venezuela or Spain. But about a year after October 62, so this would have been about October 63, she did get to the airport with her visa and exit permit, and they sent her home. And they said to her, go home. We need your seat for someone more important. Start over again. This happened to her a year later. Same thing, over again. This happened to thousands of parents, including parents of two of my friends, two people I know personally. The father died at the airport of a heart attack when told, go home and start over again. Writing Waiting for Snow in Havana, I wanted it published as fiction. You see. And I would have much rather had seen it as fiction because I didn't want anyone to know about the nasty details of my life, especially my torturing lizards and stuff like that. But my editor said to me, you know, if a reader comes across this and doesn't have to ask, did this really happen? Then it will have a more powerful impact. And she was right. She was absolutely right. No one can challenge a testimony if I stand up here and say my mother was turned back at the airport twice, and I know many, many others who were too, who wanted to reunite with their children. No one can deny this. So this is the power of memory and the power of history from memory of an eyewitness account. But beyond that, you know, I think that as in the case of the other book, I want to start wrapping up now so that we can have a question and answer period. There is something universal about childhood. Children relate at a certain level because there's a certain universality to childhood. An account of childhood, no matter what country you're basing your account in, will transcend national, cultural, ethnic boundaries, even religious boundaries, because there's a certain sameness to childhood around the world. So that writing with the voice of a child gives an account even more, I think, more power as testimony. It also reaches more broadly. And as it was the case with Waiting for Snow in Havana, I hope this book has a certain depth to it, universality that goes beyond merely the story of my life or that of my brother or the lives of the 14,000 kids or even Cuba itself. It's the puzzle of life, really. The puzzle that we all have to learn to constantly become other people. And here I'm going to get a little philosophical on you before I sign off because this is my deepest obsession as a historian concerning memory. You know, our memories are flawed. We don't always remember things the same way others do who lived through them. And I think the last time I was here, I gave you a couple of examples. And if you weren't here, I'll mention one of them, for instance. In Waiting for Snow in Havana, I said, I couldn't remember that I actually said, none of my friends came to say goodbye. Well, a few years later, after the book had been published, I met someone who was in fact there. And he had the shocking news for me that not only was he there, but that moment changed his life because it was his first step towards prison. Seeing our family divided in Havana made him think about what the revolution was doing. A few years later, he says the wrong thing to the wrong person, and he ends up in jail for 8 years. And I had no memory of this. I still don't. I have to believe him because of the details he gave me. So memory is flawed, but memory offers testimony. But here's my puzzle. We all have this memory, right? And none of the cells that we have in our bodies right now, all of us in this room, none of the cells we have are the cells we were born with. All our cells have changed, including the cells in our brain. Yet we remember the past. How is that possible? How do we remember? Of course, the hard-line materialists will say it's like software, you know. The new cells pick up the memories, and so wherever it is that they're stored. But what I like to think, what I prefer to think, actually it's the only thing I can think that will keep me sane, is that if in fact we do die constantly in this life and are reborn constantly in this life, why should we think that our physical death is the final death and that there's no more life after that? To me, that seems more inconceivable than the opposite. And in a way, that's the central argument of this book, which is kind of hidden in the text, that we should hope to continue this process of being reborn constantly, perhaps one would hope forever and ever, growing constantly and changing and adapting. And I'll leave you with that because I've already gone on for more than 30 minutes, and I'd like to leave time for questions. Thank you. Yes.
There it is. I'm not questioning what you said, but I am interested in knowing how were you able to find out and where that there were 50,000 other children left holding visas.
No, it's
80,000. I'm sorry, 80,000.
It's 80,000. It's the people who ran this program in Havana. There were three individuals who ran this. And the minute the door was slammed shut, all three of them were arrested, and each of them spent 20 years or so in prison. They eventually made it to the U.S. They had the numbers. It was run out of one woman's house. And it's been corroborated sort of by triangulation of the numbers, the stories of families, of children who eventually made it to the U.S. and were left holding their permit. There are the figures, right? The papers, nobody could take papers out of Cuba. But the three people involved with this program did leave and had the data in their memories. So, but it stands to reason about 80,000 would be about right because this program was pure carte blanche. They had a mimeograph machine. And on the document it said U.S. Department of State at the top, but it was really cranked out of this one house in Havana. And they cranked them out. Anyone who came to the door and asked for one, they gave them one. Yeah.
There's three of us here from Wilmington. We happen to be Pedro Pans also. And I always thought that it was an operation between the CIA and the Catholic Church. And you say that it was really nothing to do with the CIA. So how do you think the operation occurred or why?
Well, I didn't say it had nothing to do with the CIA.
But it was a big failure of the CIA.
No, I didn't say that either. I said that if it was a propaganda thing, it was a big failure as a propaganda thing. It began as an effort to get the children of counter-revolutionaries out of Cuba. These were men and women, some of whom, very few of whom, were working with the CIA. The vast majority of them were not. It mushroomed very quickly because the way Cubans share everything. You know, a mother would say, well, yeah, I got my kid out. How did you get your kid out? Next thing you know, it's completely out of control. And the highest number of kids left after April 61, after the Bay of Pigs, after it became clear that there was going to be a long wait before anything changed. So it's quite clear that Ruston Academy, this American school in Havana, the headmaster, had connections with the U.S. State Department. He wanted to get some kids out of his school, some of whom, well, all of whom, all these kids he wanted to get out, their parents were fighting against Fidel Castro. A few of them had CIA connections, but most did not. But this was the inroad that James Baker, headmaster of Ruston Academy, had in Washington. Then he meets up with this Irish priest in Miami, Monsignor Walsh, who has his own connections in Washington. And they put two and two together. Okay, I'm going to be sending boys from Ruston Academy. You take them in. It mushroomed at this end, too. So it wasn't really the Catholic Church. It was all federal money. And nowadays, I think the program would have been declared unconstitutional because the camps were run by Archdiocese of Miami. But there were other agencies involved because there were a fair number of Chinese kids, there was a fair number of Jewish kids, and also a fair number of Protestant kids. So all these different agencies were involved too. But the CIA angle is something that's very, very small. It's almost inconsequential, but has been blown completely out of proportion. Because here's the narrative. Okay, here's the narrative, which I get all the time. It's a narrative generated by Fidel Castro and those who support him. Fidel Castro was loved by the Cuban people. Fidel Castro had virtually no resistance or tiny amount of resistance at all from Cubans. The only one who offered him resistance was the big, mean old neighbor to the north, the Empire of the United States, and its dastardly agency, the CIA. So therefore, only the CIA could cook up a program like this because no one in Cuba was in charge of any such thing. And I just answered two of those emails today about this narrative. You know, there's this myth that Fidel Castro was a nice guy who was pushed into the arms of the Soviet Union by the mean old imperialist U.S. and the CIA. That otherwise he would have been great if Eisenhower and Kennedy hadn't screwed up so badly. And the CIA intrusion into the Pedro Pan airlift, that narrative is part of that other larger narrative, which is basically the big lie with a capital B and a capital L. Yeah, in the back. So I'll call to you on the front, but yeah. Right there, right next to you there.
Carlos, my name is Carlos Del Sol, or Charlie. I left 25 days after you did from Cuba. My younger brother and I came. We hit Lara number one, and then we came with to live with relatives initially. And after the Cuban Missile Crisis, like your parents, my parents thought that we're just going to come here, learn English, and go back, and this would never last. And then we live in a foster home until our parents came in early 1966. I want to thank you for writing the book. When I first read the first book, it really brought back many, many memories of my life. And it opened some things that were hidden in my memory that I have even forgotten. Hmm. You said a couple things in your talk. One of those was would you do the same thing with your kids? We have two daughters. When our daughters were 12, that's the question that I asked my wife. Would we have done the same thing for our daughter? That's a tough question. I don't know what I would have done. My mom is 93, living in Miami. And periodically, she'll ask, do you think we did the right things? Yeah. And by the way, my dad passed away a year after they arrived here in this country. So, you know, I want to thank you for writing these books, because I don't think there are many of us that came to this country. Mm-hmm. We've been very, very successful, and it portrays who we are. And, again, thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Yes. Right there, right next to you.
Thank you.
It's the light is shining on the two of you. It's not fair.
I, too, enjoyed your first book, and I'm looking forward to reading the next installation. My family left Cuba in 1969, and I was first born American in 1970. So I very much agree with your characterization of the destruction of the country of Cuba and, worst of all, what happened to Cuban families. However, with those that call you a liar and the Castro defenders, how do you reply to them when I would imagine they say that, A, that as collateral damage of the revolution, that you have a bone to pick with the regime? And secondly, it's my understanding that you haven't been back since you left. So you have, from what I've read in interviews,
right.
So that, you know, how would you know? I mean, because very often when I talk to Castro defenders, they often go visit the island with church groups and things of that sort, and what they see is a wonderful place. So they don't necessarily see what you see. So what would be your reply to a Castro defender that says, A, that you have a bone to pick as collateral damage, and B, that you haven't been back?
Well, those are good questions, and it take a long time to answer them fully, but the brief version is this. Question number one, I have a bone to pick. Yeah, of course I do. What's wrong with that? You know, what's wrong with a collateral damage to what? What have they created? What replaced the Cuba that was there before? Free education? Give me a break. It's not free, and it's brainwashing. Medical care is abysmal. That's one of the two things that people usually mention. Medical care is, well, it's for everybody. I point out to people, you know, the Third Reich had free education and universal health care, too. They did. So did Stalin's Soviet Union. It's what goes along with it. The real collateral damage is not what happened to me or to the other kids. The real collateral damage is what happened to the millions of Cubans who lived on the island, whose lives were ruined. Short version of the answer. Every single book review for Waiting for Snow in Havana, and I'm waiting for it to happen with this too, every single book review but one in The New Yorker, all the others said, what a shame that this book was written by this man, because he was privileged. This book would have been much better if written by a poor boy. That's what one review said. Since when is it fair to rob people of their possessions and of their freedom simply because they have more than others? If that were so, everyone in this room, right, would be collateral damage too. The second question, what was it? The second one?
You haven't been back.
I haven't been back. I can't go back because I've been pronounced an enemy of the state. But I keep in touch with people who are recently arrived, and I keep in touch with the few bloggers who are now sneaking reports out of Havana, including one who just won a prize yesterday, Yoani Sanchez. If any of you are interested, read her blogs. They're available in English, Generation Y. She gives you little tiny slices of life, of what life is like in Cuba right now. And she has, really, her essays are not full of political agendas. They're simply descriptions of life in Cuba. And she just won a $50,000 prize yesterday, but she's not going to be allowed to leave the country to collect it. She's received similar prizes and has not been allowed out. So I stay in touch. I stay in touch. And I have an uncle who still lives there, and I'm very much in touch with him. So I'm informed as anybody can be, even though I can't go there. Yes, in the back, red sweater.
I have two questions. As a child of privilege, you had a very different
upbringing than under Batista than other people in Cuba. I happen to know some. When I moved to Philadelphia, there were some Cuban exiles here. That's my first question. The second one is, how many children, poor children, were able to leave Cuba? I mean, let's talk about, you know, give me a, can you, do you have any figures
on
that?
Well, no one has exact figures, but I see where you're going with your question. The airlift was a cross-section of Cuba. Actually, very few wealthy kids left on the airlift. They left. All the really wealthy left where they could still leave with all their money. Cuba had the largest middle class in all of Latin America. Most Americans don't know this. Okay. Cuba had more television sets in 1958 than all of Italy. I'm not talking per capita. I'm talking television sets. Cuba was a very advanced society that had about the same degree of poverty as the town in which I work, New Haven, Connecticut. It's exactly the same. When every time I drive to work in New Haven, I say to myself, well, you know, this place needs a revolution too. And I say to my colleagues, you know, your million point two house. Because they say to me the same thing. Oh, you were privileged, so you have no right to speak. And I say to them, well, why don't you give your house to the poor in New Haven? The fact is, Cuba had 80% literacy in 1958. Cuba had poverty, yes, but Philadelphia has poverty. I saw plenty of it today, too. Does that mean that everyone with property should be stripped of it? I don't think so. I don't think so. Numbers, the vast majority of kids who left on the airlift were middle class. And I mean middle class, not upper middle class, but middle class, and plenty of poor kids. Three of the kids I lived with, their parents were fisher people, fishermen, subsistence fishermen, not commercial fishermen, but poor people leave Cuba all the time because poor people don't like having their soul and mind stolen either. And this is what many Americans can't seem to grasp is that, you know, let me back up a second. Experience I had at a college in Maryland where an honors student had just been to Cuba, and she was very upset that I didn't think it was wonderful. And with tears streaming down her cheek, she says to me, but how can you not appreciate the fact that in the third world, the only right, the only human right that matters is a full plate of food, and it doesn't matter how that plate gets there? And I said to her, you are the worst racist I have ever encountered. How dare you say that? How dare you say that some human beings on earth have different rights simply because they live in a different place? So, as you can tell, I'm getting a little hot under the collar because I don't like privileged people telling me that I have no right to speak about my native country because I was privileged. And anyone who is in this room tonight is somewhat at least privileged. Yes.
I'd like to go in a different direction.
Yeah.
I have absolutely no connection to Cuba. I couldn't go on my high school science trip because of Fidel. So I want to talk about your writing. I thank you for your delight in language, and it was a delight to read you and enjoy that with you. One gift that I found in the book, I work in the psychological field, and I was in a meeting where we were talking about a young man this week and whose life story is very different, but it involved a cultural transplant and some feelings of unreality on his part. And I found myself telling the people in the room about reading your book and the great void, the vault of oblivion.
Mm-hmm.
These are real gifts, and I thank you.
Well, thanks. It's, you know, it's not easy for, we all hear this, and you're in the field, so, you know, kids are resilient, right? They are. But what I've found out, and almost every kid finds out, you're resilient till you're about 30, right? And then it kind of, the funniest question I've had anyone ask me from any audience hand goes up, I call on the person, and I swear to God, she began this way. And when you finally sought psychological help, yeah, ... This assumption was, of course, that I had the strangest and most difficult speaking engagement I've had was at the Florida Psychoanalytic Association, where they were doing a study of childhood trauma. So I was there as a poster child, for, I guess, for childhood trauma. But everything that I had carefully prepared for my audience, they were all Freudian psychoanalysts, so they didn't respond to anything I said. And at the end, I finally had it. I said, well, thank you. It's been very nice speaking to you. And it's also nicer to know I won't receive 250 bills for, 250 hours of therapy. Nobody laughed. You've had your hand up for a while, and I'll get to you back then.
What is your guess as to what might happen in Cuba once those Castro brothers die off? Is there any cause for some hope that things could change there?
Well, the only hope I have is that the only good thing about death is that it takes the bad people too. And that everyone who's in charge of Cuba right now is in their 80s. Or 70s. I think the youngest general is in his upper 60s. So the clock is ticking on them. Something will, it'll have to change. How it will change is anybody's guess. However, there are certain things to take into account. I mean, the infrastructure of that country is totally wrecked. Over half of the arable land is just not being used, and it's been taken over by an invasive weed that is so wicked you have to tear all the soil off in order to get rid of it. There's no industry. The buildings are crumbling. The population has doubled since 1958, and virtually no new housing has gone up. That's the challenge faced, the infrastructure. But you do have 2 million Cubans in exile. 20% of the population is in exile. We've all done fairly well in exile. Want to help. People, there's also this myth we all want to go back and claim our property and steal it from the poor people. But that's not so. You know, the people with know-how of how capitalism works that can go back and help. But nobody knows because the control is so tight right now that there's no telling what will happen next. We have to wait another 10 years or so, I think. Yes. Right there in the middle. And then you're next, way in the back, okay?
Thank you for taking my question. What is your opinion on the question of suspending or doing away with the sanctions that many people feel hurt the people more than they punish the regime itself?
Yeah. Well, here's the deal. Number of myths that have to be straightened out. Myths are not necessarily untrue, as any scholar of religion should tell you. The deepest truths are conveyed by myths. But there is this idea that the embargo has kept Cuba poor, and that's not the case. The reason Cuba is poor is because of its central planning, which has killed its economy. Cuba can buy whatever it wants from anywhere else in the world, and it does. Here's where we stand right now. November 16th, 2010. The U.S. is Cuba's fourth largest trading partner. Almost every chicken, if not every chicken, eaten in Cuba, which, by the way, are not eaten by Cubans, but only by tourists, comes from Tyson Farms. I had someone tell me in Alabama with great pride, expanding his chest, he says, you know, every telephone pole in Cuba comes from Alabama. And so on and so forth. Trade with Cuba is enormous. What the embargo amounts to right now is two things. Cuba cannot buy manufactured goods from the U.S., but as we all know, damn few things are manufactured in the U.S. And that's one of our main problems. Item number two, Cuba has to pay cash up front before the goods are delivered. They get no credit whatsoever. People who call for the lifting of the embargo, what they're really calling for is granting Cuba credit. I just saw it in the paper today. You can check it out. I think it was an AP report. Cuba owes Venezuela $15 billion. Practically all the hotel chains in Cuba, which are for foreigners only, owned mostly by Spanish hotel chains, have not been paid in 2 years. Doing business with Cuba is risky. There are a lot of Midwestern farmers and Southern farmers especially who are eager to see the embargo lifted because they think they're going to be able to sell more. But in fact, what's going to happen is, yes, they will, quote-unquote, sell more at credit and not get paid. So, you know, as an American, I don't like the fact that Americans are forbidden to visit Cuba. Why should a government tell you where you can go or you can't go? In that respect, you know, I say, it's just something not right about that. However, back in the 1980s, anyone who wanted to could travel to South Africa. Yet, no one dared to travel to South Africa because the population as a whole considered it highly immoral to visit South Africa and spend money in a place that unjust. I got news for you. Cuba has apartheid, too. All those generals I keep talking about who run the government, not a single one is black. And the population of Cuba right now is 60 to 70% black. And it goes down the line like that. Hardly any ministers are black. Blacks get discriminated against all the time. And if you don't believe me, I can recommend a book to you. Eugene Robinson, columnist for the Washington Post. Wonderful book, Last Dance in Havana. He went there to study Cuban music and thought, as a person of African descent, he would finally be in a post-racial society. Instead, what he found was the worst racism he had ever encountered. And it's detailed in that book, page after page after page. And this has nothing to do with left or right, because Robinson is self-avowed liberal. So that's where I stand on this. It's a complex issue. I say, open the doors. Let all Americans travel to Cuba who want to. But let's start a campaign to treat Cuba just like we treated South Africa, all simultaneously.
Carlos,
yeah. Okay, there was one in the back I promised. Yes.
When did you feel comfortable or feel like you belonged in the United States, if ever?
Oh, boy, is that a good question. When did I finally feel like I belonged? I think it's when I got to Bloomington, Illinois, finally. You know, in Miami, I was one of nearly a million Cubans. I was just one of them. I get to a city in Illinois that at that time had virtually no foreigners except for a whole bunch of old Germans who ran the Americanization program. And in my school, there are only two of us who had not been born in the U.S. in my class. The other kid was German, and he had a very German name. I had become Chuck already. He couldn't change his first name, or didn't want to. His first name was Rutger. So he got all the abuse, and I was just another kid, because by that time, I was already talking like Andy Griffith. And one incident, this is when I knew I was at home. And to me, this incident represents this country better than anything else that had happened to me in all the time I've been here. The bane of my existence has always been what people expect from a Cuban. I'm supposed to be a good dancer. I'm also supposed to be very good at baseball. In school, I was always the first one picked for softball games. So I'm picked first. I strike out. One kid comes up to me, spits in my face, and calls me a dirty spick. All the other kids in the gym class jumped on him and beat him up. And one of them came up to me and said, "Don't listen to Max. He's an idiot." That's when I knew. This is America, right? This is what it's all about. Yeah, we've got some idiots, but the vast majority don't think that way. And everybody who wants to be, this is the thing, everyone who wants to be an American can become an American. It's those who kind of resist that end up being feeling alienated because they're resisting. It's the beauty of this country is, you know, especially living also after Bloomington in Chicago, everyone came from somewhere else. And at my high school, our foreign exchange student was a WASP from Ohio. So, thank you. Thank you. Thank you all. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.